Welcome to Not Enough Champagne. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and I'm discussing universal credit with two councillors from Birmingham. One of them is called Nikki Brennan.
Hello. Nikki.
And one of them is called John Cotton.
Hi.
So universal credit was rolled out into Birmingham in December. It's having quite disastrous consequences for many of the poorest in Birmingham and across Britain as well. We're going to try and focus on two issues where it's particularly disastrous. One is on women and one is on housing. Universal Credit was designed by Ian Duncan Smith, previously known as a really, really rubbish leader of the Conservative Party. The idea was to get rid of all benefits, all the other types of benefit payments, and basically replace it with one big benefit payment that everyone would get paid instead. There's a report which we'll link to on the podcast called Rough Justice by CPAG, and they talk about a couple of problems with it. One of them is that the calculation of payments happens month by month, so people don't get a set amount every month. That varies depending on how much they're paid, which makes budgeting really, really difficult. The other thing that's the problem is because of how paydays might work, so sometimes it might be a slightly different payday because it falls on the weekend or falls on the bank holiday. Sometimes people would get two universal payment credits in a month, and sometimes they wouldn't get one at all and they'd have to wait 2 months for a payment, and that also made budgeting really, really difficult. Other problem they said was that it was meant to model the world of work, which meant that it was paid in lieu, which means that people often had 2 months before being paid, which almost epitomises the problem with it, doesn't it? Is that this is designed by people who assume you've got a nice bank of savings to fall back on, and they think that you don't need to worry about surviving hand to mouth.
I was looking at the Ian Duncan Smith thing that you've just said. Guido Fawkes said yesterday, Ian Duncan Smith did more to help people escape a life of poverty on welfare into the world of work with prospects than anyone else in the last decade.
I think my bullshitometer has just exploded.
Well, the daft thing is, I suppose, that the government at the moment is trumpeting their record low in unemployment rates. But the reason they're that low is because it's a lot of part-time work, it's a lot of zero-hours contracts, it's a lot of precarious work. And a lot of these people who are working are not only having the problems of universal credit, where you've got problems with budgeting and not knowing how much you've got coming in, but also a lot of people in work now are having to go to food banks because they can't afford to live.
I see it a lot as a councillor, people that are working all the hours, the day's ends, coming in to see me for food bank vouchers for their families because of universal credit. It's just an absolute disaster.
One thing to also try and mirror the world of work, and because all work obviously is proper salaried work, you get those payments every month. Whereas usually I think the Resolution Foundation found 58% of people on universal credit, usually they were being paid, who were being moved to it, were paid weekly or fortnightly, which again makes budgeting and managing finances even harder.
Yeah, it's clearly designed by people who have no concept of how life is lived by many people. And also of the precarious nature of many people's work lives. It's ironic given that the people who are responsible for the designing of this are also responsible for a lot of that instability and precariousness that people who are in work are facing.
Or driving people out of poverty and into work, as I think it's meant to be called, John.
I think with like universal credit as well, there's a lot of people that are on universal credit that have zero-hour contracts. Now, with a zero-hour contract, if you decide that you're going to go on holiday for a week, you don't get paid because you don't get holiday pay. And I think if you're used to getting an amount of universal credit each month, it just kind of throws the figures in the air and you could be getting a completely different payment and it's not considered at all.
And Nikki, if we start with the disastrous impact universal credit's had on women in particular, I mean, there's organisations like Women's Aid, aren't they, who've looked at the impact of universal credit on women. What is it they've generally found?
Well, if we're talking about domestic violence victims here, if you have a woman that has an abusive partner and they are on benefits, before the woman would usually get tax credits, it was, most of the time it would be payable to a woman and she'd have her own kind of income. But now it's just going through as one payment. So the partner that's abusive has then a whole full handle on all of the finances. So she'd have no money. And it's a way of controlling somebody, if financial control. You're not going to be able to leave an abusive relationship if you've got no money or you've got no savings. Then when women do leave, they come to refuge, you're on universal credit, you might not get a payment for a month, you have to feed your children, they might give you, what they do a lot of the time is they offer you a loan, so they'll offer you like £1,500 upfront payment that then you have to pay back monthly. And at the time you're desperate, so you think, yeah, this is a good idea, you take it, you're in debt. And then the little that they pay you in universal credit, you're having like £100 taken off you each month. So you're struggling even more.
I couldn't believe that if you move into temporary accommodation like refuge accommodation or a hostel, you're not eligible for universal credit that month and not eligible for any housing payments that month. That literally is insane.
Yeah. And it's really impacting people. I think if you were thinking, I'm going to leave, I want to leave, I need to leave, and you hear a story about a woman that's left and she's got no money and she's struggling, you might think twice, and you know that could cost a woman's life.
Also, something that happened some time ago was the removal of the kind of crisis support that you used to be able to get through the social fund. So back in the coalition government days, one of the things they did was abolish the social fund, which was administered by DWP, pass the responsibility on to local authorities, and it was rebadged as local welfare provision. I was cabinet member responsible for some of this at the time, and basically they passed it over to local authorities without the same amount of money that would have been spent on the social fund. This thing got pared further and further back. So you were trying to provide crisis support to people with less and less money as demand for crisis support was going up. And because it has now been passed on to local authorities, there are local authorities that have just removed any local welfare provision altogether. Sometimes because, you know, the impact of the other cuts they're having to deal with. So again, another form of crisis support, another safety net that people had has been taken away.
And was that safety net almost removed? Was that pushed down from the central government to local authorities almost to try and blame them for it? Or is that just political incompetence?
Yeah, it was a clear case of passing the buck. This was in the early stages of the benefits and austerity cuts, as I say, that happened under the coalition government, and it was a handy little ruse really to say, oh well, we've passed it down to localities and they can design something that works locally, but without any of the budget that was that the DWP previously had to provide that support.
Oh, I remember being a young mum and coming out of like hostel refuge. And I was moved into my first property, Birmingham City Council property, and I was given a grant by government so I could buy things like furniture. Mm. So my daughter had a bed to sleep in, so I could have an oven so I could cook her food, and now that's completely gone. So I know there's some help with like white goods. Yeah. It's quite kind of tricky to apply for it. But if you're escaping violence and you're moving into your first house, you've got nothing. You haven't even got a chair to sit on. They will fund nothing for you.
And one thing that I thought was particularly interesting or terribly depressing was the issue of split payments. So you mentioned if you're in an abusive relationship, usually one person is paid that payment, and usually that it can be used by the abuser to keep control. What you can apply for is a split payment, I think. So some payment goes to both partners, except if a woman in an abusive relationship, I think, does apply for that split payment, their partner is notified, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
And that surely is not a terribly good idea.
No.
No.
It's really not. It's just putting women in harm's way.
And one thing, I think it was in a Women's Day report on this, is that often I think higher income women often aren't believed in these kind of situations.
Yeah, so you'll have to prove that you're a domestic violence victim before you can get support. I think it kind of varies from different places, so they might want like police involvement or something. It's not just good enough to say, I've been a victim. Like with child maintenance, you can say, I've been a victim of domestic abuse, and they'll waiver fees for you. I think it's different with universal credit.
And it's just shocking, really, that there's a wealth of expertise and experience with domestic violence organisations and others. And there's just been a refusal to take any of this on board in designing the system. It's just obscene.
Is it just because there's an arrogance there? Do you think it's just that they don't care? Is it just...
No, it's a benefit cut. It's to cut people's benefits, and it's to make it so awkward that you do not want to apply for it.
And that seems to be half the thing, I suppose, is it seems to be very much a computer says no approach from the people involved in trying to assign universal credit and give it out.
I think as well, a lot of experience with people I've talked to is when you do go to the job centre and you are speaking to another human being about what's going on, it's very much a kind of straight face, dehumanising, I think, because they get so many people coming in saying the same thing. They've kind of lost their emotion talking to people. And if you're in a crisis and you're kind of with this person that's got like a poker face and they've got no kind of humanity to you, it's even worse.
Mm. The other issue, if we could talk about that, John, was... as housing.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of the latest instalment in a long succession of things that have made it very difficult for people to meet the housing costs. If we just look at what's happened with the Birmingham City Council, because of course we're still a substantial landlord in our own right, we've got 63,000 properties. 7,000 of the tenants for Birmingham City Council properties are on universal credit. And at the moment, because of those issues around the delay in payments and the other issues that we've talked about, we've got 130 tenants a week falling into arrears because of universal credit. So if you think about it, 11% of the tenants are on universal credit and 2/3 of those are in arrears because of the issues that universal credit's caused.
And those issues mainly, are they around budgeting, like we talked about before?
Yeah, so you've got issues around budgeting, you've got issues about that initial period where people apply for universal credit and you've got the delay and they're essentially having to borrow against the payments they're getting later, which is just a utterly perverse system. So it's no wonder we're now looking at an arrears balance of 5 million just in terms of the City Council's housing account because of the chaos that's caused. If you then think about what that means for people in private rented sector provision, and given that we already know that the number one reason for people presenting as homeless to the council is now failure of private rented sector tenancies, and that's before the whole of the universal credit juggernaut has kind of hit people, it's you can see what the consequences are, and they're not good.
Well, so a lot of private landlords are now refusing to take tenants with universal credit, aren't they?
Yeah, you'll see it on like Rightmove. It will say like, no pets, no universal credit. It's like, how to dehumanise people even more.
Yeah.
Is that legal?
Well, it shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be.
And then in plain language, are we basically saying that Birmingham Council's basically is owed 5 million quid because people can't pay their rent because of universal credit?
Yeah, it's created that situation. Now, the council has been working on a pilot project with the Job Centre Pluses locally to try and provide support to people and sort out some of the, particularly the application issues early on. So we reckon that as a result of doing that, that level of arrears is about £700,000 lower than it otherwise would be. But when you think in terms of 5 million, you know, it's we're doing what we can, but we're dealing with a tsunami of a problem. So, you know, issues like this whole waiting period needs fixing. But bluntly, the system has been designed in such a way that it's creating absolute chaos for people. But it comes on top of a whole set of other changes and so-called reforms, which aren't reforms, they're cuts, that have hit housing market and housing provision in Birmingham over the last few years. You know, we go back to where we started with this, with the bedroom tax, which, you know, hit 14,000 households across the city. The provisions that were... The stuff that was supposed to be put in place to soften the impact of that wasn't adequate to the need. And it's difficult to avoid the conclusion that this is just about making it very difficult for people and for, you know, cutting the cost of benefits rather than providing the support and the social mobility that people need.
And those payments to help families with stuff like the bedroom tax, are they the discretionary housing payments that the local authority was given?
So what happened originally when bedroom tax was first rolled out, the effect of that was basically the equivalent of taking 11 million out of the housing benefit system in Birmingham. The pot that they gave the council in discretionary housing benefits at that time, and I'm going back 3 or 4 years now, was 4.5 million. So, you know, do the maths. You ain't going to cover an 11 million gap with 4.5 million. But again, it's about passing the buck, I think, down to local authorities without the resources to deal with it. And we're left picking up the pieces, which is record numbers of homeless presentations and everything else.
And with those discretionary payments that a local authority pays to meet housing costs like the bedroom tax and what have you, you only get them if you're on universal credit, don't you? So if you are off universal credit for any reason, maybe your payment gets missed or you become a student, for instance, then you lose your housing payment too.
Yeah.
Right. Or apparently if you move to a lower rented property, which presumably is the point of the bedroom tax, I suppose, wasn't it? Was to try and move people out.
Yeah.
Then you also lose out and your payment, according to the Rough Justice report again, your payment may not cover your rent.
Yeah. And this is increasingly an issue with some of the other changes that have taken place to housing benefits over the last few years. So, you know, you look at what's happened to the to younger people, for instance, and the shared accommodation rate that they bought in. So the assumption being that if you're under 35, you're not entitled to having your housing costs picked up to live on your own. The assumption is you'll share with somebody. Now, think about the safeguarding and safety implications of that as well.
Hmm.
Yeah, especially with what we're seeing with some landlords in the city that are exploiting vulnerable young women by offering them rooms in houses in exchange for sex. I think universal credit and things all play into that as well. It's just there to exploit vulnerable people.
What are the solutions? I mean, the Rough Justice report says that there are some solutions, like you could try and use average earnings over a period to calculate rather than look month by month, or having regular monthly payments, or maybe changing the dates of an assessment period, or if we think about, say, the domestic violence issues and women there, that you make sure that you do pay payments, say like child benefit, to the woman in the relationship. Are reforms like that going to help, or do we need a complete overhaul of the system?
My sense is that with this, the kind of reforms that you talk about is a bit like trying to reassemble the aeroplane while it's in flight. You know, you can tinker with this, but you actually then add complexity to it, which isn't going to help those people. What we need to do is just, I think, stop the thing and go back to first principles. You need, I think, a simple system that people can navigate easily, that is about providing support and the opportunity, mobility to people, rather than simply just cutting the overall cost of the benefits bill. My view would be you just need to scrap this and start again.
Yeah, I agree. I don't see how pausing it, trying to fix it and then rolling it back out again is going to help anybody. I think people need to be paid welfare that's actually going to help them, not like a tiny bit of crumbs that's just not going to help anybody.
So a radical solution of trying to maybe pay people what they need to live, rather than like
proper
not
jobs and proper welfare and not 0-hour contracts. And
I suppose, I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? It's not just seeing this through a prism of benefits and paying money out. It's also about making sure people have those workers' rights, have a unionised workplace where they're more likely to have a higher salary and more secure jobs, that kind of thing. Ed Miliband call it pre-distribution. We obviously need a sexier term for it.
I'm not sure that's ever going to catch on, but you know, good old-fashioned dose of socialism, social justice and equality. I'll buy that.
Might help a little bit. I think maybe the government needs to actually stop and speak to the people that this is impacting, and maybe try and have a go themselves at living through applying for universal credit. I think they'd stop it straight away.
And at the moment, it's the DWP Secretary's estimate Vey, isn't it, who I think was responsible for putting through a lot of these changes beforehand, so probably isn't likely to be receptive to any new approach, sort of thing.
She was invited to a food bank in her constituency, I think, last week, and it was about school children receiving uniforms because their parents couldn't afford to buy them uniforms, and she refused. So she doesn't want to go and see what her policies and how they're impacting ordinary people.
That shows a political sureness of touch, doesn't it?
Well, you know, perhaps you should go and talk to the Archbishop of Canterbury, who I think made it also very clear this week. I was just struck by his phrase, where universal credit comes in, hunger, debt, food bank use goes up. And, you know, I don't always agree with archbishops on things, but I think he probably speaks for us all that comment.
They've turned on him, which I thought was quite interesting as well. That is the Tories turning on the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Yeah, absolutely. The church should stay out of politics and should not have views on things like social justice.
Well, yeah, was it the IEA or someone, or the Adam Smith Institute, that was like, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's? And you think, you don't understand what the Bible means, do you? That's not what the quote was about.
What would Jesus do?
Apparently there's a whole big book about this.
Yeah. But they turned on religion and business all in one day. It was like, yeah, this is the end.
The Tory party's changed.
I suppose that's... especially when the myth of Ian Duncan Smith, or the narrative Ian Duncan Smith's got, as you kind of said, from quoting people like Guido, is it's very much from a kind of Christian socialist, or Christian perspective, that kind of the centre for social justice and all about being the good of work and trying to get people out of work, and like a very, very moral mission into it, but just doesn't seem to have worked out that way.
Yeah, and again, it comes back to, given the benefit of the doubt, I've no doubt there was, you know, a genuine interest in those social questions. But you then can't sit in a cabinet as the Secretary of State while, as a result of the decisions the Chancellor's taking, you know, huge chunks are being taken out of welfare and associated budgets. And I don't understand how you can just sit by and allow that to happen if you're genuinely interested in supporting people and giving them a genuine route out of poverty. Claims that he resigned eventually because of it, but frankly, he should have put the resignation letter in about 4 years before he did.
But also, it's interesting, time resignation 4 months before the Brexit referendum as well.
So I'm sure that's purely coincidental.
Obviously, sorry, John, I'm being cynical again. But I suppose wasn't it Frank Field, I think, of all people, who was, I think, Tony Blair appointed in 97 to think the unthinkable in welfare, and wanted to do this kind of thing, didn't he, and try and merge the different payments, and found that it was too complicated and wouldn't really work. As we've kind of talked about, it's a weird kind of place the Tory party is in at the moment, where it's more like the traditional conservatism. It's meant to be about government leaving alone. It's meant to be about the Tory party at prayer as the Church of England and looking after big business. And now you have Dominic Raab turning on businesses like John Lewis. You've got them attacking the Archbishop of Canterbury. You've got them trying really top-down reorganisations that don't work, like the NHS organisations under Lansley, like Universal Credit. Even the Boundary Commission reforms reviews an example of a kind of top-down approach that doesn't really work. It's a kind of interesting, just intellectual nonsense, really.
It's the Conservative Party's actually stopped being conservative in a traditional sense. In that, you know, you don't mess around with things too much.
If you were to speak, well, when, say, if, Jeremy Corbyn brings up things at the dispatch box against May, and he says there's lots of families that are in work poverty, and she'll just quote employment figures, and it's something we had in council when we had our food banks debate. We were told, no, this is not the government's fault. There's more people in work. There's unemployment is at the lowest record levels, and it's just like they've got their fingers in their ears and they're not listening to what's actually happening.
In this estimate based case, sounds like literally is the case as well.
Yeah.
On that happy note, if you would like to read more from us, you can see it on our website, notenoughchampagne.com, on our Facebook page, facebook.com/notenoughchampagne, or on our Twitter handle, which is @nochampagnepod. I'm scrounging away on Twitter @paperbackwriter.
I'm tweeting away @councillor John Cotton.
And I'm on Nikki E. Brennan.
Happy plotting, everyone.